Welcome to War Gaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Today, we're going to be talking about something really cool. So for those of you who are longtime listeners, you probably are aware that I've talked about both this amazing company, Things from the Basement, and also about this really cool MDF kit that they sell, the USS Adrian Benson. And if you're a newer listener to the show, there's this really cool company called Things from the Basement, and among the many things that they sell is an MDF kit called the USS Adrian Benson. So today, I'm actually joined by the owner of Things from the Basement, the one, the only, Mr. Jorg Benson. Jorg, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm so happy to have you here with us. This is like a dream come true, because with pandemic, it's been ridiculous. I haven't seen people in ages.
Yeah, same on my end. I mean, it has cost us 2 years, right? Of our hobby, more or less, at least playing with others
right.
in person.
I mean, for me, I'm immune compromised. So the last thing I went to was Total Con in 2020. And then I hid is basically what it was. And yeah. I just kind of laid low. But I mean, a lot of the stuff shut down and some of them kind of opened up a little bit in 2021. Some did, not really, a few maybe. And then 2022, I know more have kind of opened up, and I've still been kind of laying low. But you've been very busy in all this time, doing many things.
Yeah, I mean, I can still work at home and design new stuff, right? And try to sell it online, as that's the main way of selling my things. This year I think it was in February. So mm-hmm. It was our first convention after COVID. That was TotalCon, a smaller yeah. convention in Massachusetts, which was nice. See some familiar faces, a lot of new faces. And now I'm looking forward to go to Historicon in 3 weeks.
Yes,
so
that's a big one.
That's mid-July. That's the biggest one we attend. And we haven't been there for 3 years. So I'm looking forward to this. I think it will kind of be a surprise, because you don't really know what to expect now.
No, and I mean, I guess nobody really knows, but right. It'll be a nice kind of bellwether for the larger conventions to see how it goes and what works and what doesn't work. And just as we get to, and I hate this phrase, but whatever the new normal happens to be for the given day, because I swear it changes 5 times a day.
Probably, yes. Yeah, you're right.
So for those who aren't familiar with you and your work and Things from the Basement, why don't you give us the elevator pitch? What is Things from the Basement and who are you?
So, yeah, I'll start with myself then. So, I mean, for those who don't really know me, they probably realize that he's speaking with a kind of weird accent. So that's a German accent. I'm German. I'm living in the US since 2014. And in 2016, I started Things from the Basement. So I have to say, I never did that kind of stuff before. So Things from the Basement focuses on laser cut MDF kits, or MDF, like that's medium dense fiber board. It's a kind of a wood or cardboard or paper or whatever material I think is the right material to use to make a kit as realistic and as playable for wargaming as possible. So I started that I purchased a laser. I jumped into the water, let's say, and gave it a try, and it worked out pretty well. About a year and a half or 2 years later, I had to invest in a bigger laser, because the one I bought was just too small and not strong enough and fast enough. So I had to up my game. And I design a lot of things, I would say. I started with kind of a fantasy range, which is called The Legend of Riverfield. I do historical buildings. I do feudal Japanese buildings. I started some Victorian science fiction kits, which also brings us then later to the USS Adrian Benson, because that's more of a Victorian sci-fi thing I designed for that special purpose. Yeah, and you get a lot of other stuff, like smaller terrain pieces that you can fit on your gaming table, like crates or containers or carts, whatever. I like the small stuff on the table because I think it adds a lot of detail and a lot of character than just a few buildings. So I always like to have a lot going on gaming tables.
So I counted the other day, and something I'd never done before. You do 13, I'm going to call them main lines, but 13 different categories of MDF terrain and tabletop accessories. You hit some of the popular ones, I think, for people, I would presume anyway. But like just among your historical stuff, you actually have, I'm looking now, so if we're going to count, if I can stretch it, and count industrial and your Frostgrave and Frostgrave stuff and Sleeping Hollow stuff, I'm going to say that you have something like all but two of your lines are, or three of your lines are historical in nature. But I think what, for me anyway, as a customer and as a wargamer, what really stands out about the types of things that you do is that a lot of companies who do this sort of stuff, they do, as you mentioned, the large buildings or any sort of buildings like that, so that, you know, you plop it on the table and you're done. But it's those smaller accessories that really, I think, make a table pop. And very few, if any, other companies do it and do it as well as you do. And so I would presume that's a big seller for you. And if not, it should be, because they're amazing. And the things that they're so ordinary, you wouldn't think about until you use it. And you're like, wait, that was the difference that you needed.
So thanks for the nice words. Yeah, you're right. They sell pretty well, usually. I mean, I don't have the numbers in my head because I didn't even know I have 30 different ranges. I trust your judgment. So, but as I said, the small stuff, I think it can be a nice little project that can be finished probably in a day. Just glue it together, add some paint and make it look nice and add it to the table right away and use it. On the other hand, I think it's a nice entry or a test kit for any new customer who hasn't done that before or hasn't used my kits before, just some others or similar stuff. So it's not a big waste of money if you don't like it, if you break it, or if you think it's too complicated to build, which I usually think they are easy to build, but I'm the designer, so I know how to build it, right? So it's hard to tell. But I think usually it's pretty straightforward. There's always, I try to create easy to follow instructions when you build a kit. So I take photos while building a kit, and you get a lot of photos in the instruction section, and you can download it. It's usually PDF files, and you can follow the process quite easily. You just need some glue. PVA glue, the white wood glue, whatever you call it in your area, and just give it a try. It's usually pretty straightforward and easy, and it doesn't matter which material, if it's really just MDF or if some cardboard elements are added, or I also use corrugated cardboard to simulate pen tiles on roofs, for example, on the Mediterranean village. Mm-hmm. And also in the Japanese range. So I try to make the kit as realistically looking as possible. I mean, the laser cutting technologies has its restrictions. Not everything is possible, but a lot of things can be done.
So one of the things that I've noticed with your kits, and I kind of picked up on it early on, is that with the instructions, I could tell they weren't done by someone who hadn't seen the kit. They weren't done by someone who, you know, looked at it once and then 10 months later that they were making the instructions, that it was clear that it was being done with intimate knowledge of it. And that might sound like a no-brainer, right? But so in my work, one of the things I have to do is I train other staff in how to do stuff. And it's much easier to do, I think, a good job with training someone and having instructions when you actually go through the steps, because then you come across something that maybe you wouldn't have thought of otherwise, or something like you're working on, you're like, oh wait, in concept you would think it should go whatever way, but then as you're actually doing it, there's like one thing that's slightly different, or that you can find an easier way to do, and that comes across with your instructions. So for me, I was very new to MDF when I started with any of your products. And so just kind of getting that feeling, it was definitely on like a subconscious level for me that like that was there, but it made a difference. It really does make it more accessible. And I think especially nowadays as the hobby's kind of growing, and I think many of us feel that it's important to grow the hobby and for it to continue on for future generations, that you want to make it accessible, because so much now with people, they have very limited time spans. Even if you're into the hobby like us, there's so much to do. So often you probably can't or don't know how or don't want to spend the time to try to figure out how to do something. You just want to know this is how it goes. And so being able to just pick up a kit from you, get the instructions, say, okay, this is what I got to do, and you're good to go, that makes a difference. And I think that kind of broadens the appeal, and it makes it, I think, so that people are willing to try some other things. Like maybe for me, Victorian science fiction isn't a huge thing. I know some people that's like their end all be all. But for others who maybe are like me, they might be willing to try something from that range, whereas they wouldn't otherwise because they're familiar with their process.
Coming back to the instructions, I think sometimes it's pretty straightforward what you have to do with two or three pieces. When you look at them, you know what to do. For example, very easy, simple example, you have a door, and I usually have a door handle that's glued inside. I mean, if you look at the pieces, it's pretty straightforward. It's in the instruction anyway, because I think there might be a total newbie looking at something like this and trying to finish a kit, and maybe even a bit more complex one without anything, just the pieces laying in front of you, that will not work. So I think there's something I need to do. And I always try to reach out to customers, if there's anything I could do better in the instructions, please let me know. Because as I said, I'm designing it, I know how to put it together.
And, yeah, absolutely.
Some steps are not necessarily have to be done in the direction or in the chronological order I put them in the instructions, but it's the way it worked for me. So there might be different ways to get to the final result. So it's up to you.
No,
but at least it gives you a pathway to the finished product.
I think having a path is better than being like, you could go about it many different ways and off you go.
Correct.
And I mean, I guess the unkind phrase for it is you want to idiot-proof something, right? In a kinder way to look at it, I would suppose, I'm going to use myself as an example, is I have two small children, and I started doing it when they were infants. And so there are times where, basically every day, I don't get enough sleep. But as a new parent, you have no sleep. And so trying to do this stuff, which is something I crazily would do, I would be so exhausted that I couldn't think straight. So I would look and be like, okay, this is what you got to do. You do this and do that. And so having it all spelled out as much as possible is helpful, I think, even for an advanced user, because maybe you have a lot on your mind. Maybe there's things going on. Maybe you didn't sleep well. I don't know. And you just might be having a rough go of it. And so just for it to kind of be easier is a nice thing.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, and then it's up to you. Do I use the instruction or do I just do it on my own?
That's true. Yeah. I know quite a few individuals who in life, they just take instructions and they toss them aside. And they're like, whatever, I'll figure it out.
That's totally fine. I don't blame them if they try to do it without. And they probably do it without. So that's fine.
It's yeah, or they
everyone,
get
everyone individually how to solve the puzzle.
or maybe they end up being a little bit like Picasso and they have a unique piece afterwards. And
yeah, I like that too. There are customers who buy kits and don't really care about what it should look like. They have their own idea. They want to kit bash it or whatever you call it. And yeah. I love that. If I see something very unusual happening to my kit, I'm very astounded at what people can do with what I thought, okay, you can do this house and that's it. But then they come up with something totally different.
They can be very creative, can't they?
Yes.
I would say you are very creative as well with your design process, because like if you're doing a real world thing, you want to make it look as much as possible like the original. But let's take the USS Adrian Benson, for example. When you were designing this, like, where do you begin? And I mean, I guess for listeners, not everyone will have seen it. So what is the USS Adrian Benson? And maybe we should back up to that first.
So the title on the kit says Exploratory Submarine USS Adrian Benson. And it's as you mentioned before, in the Victorian science fiction range. So I think we will talk about Adrian a bit in a few minutes. So yeah. Let's say, so I knew it would be a submarine. So that was where my design process started, let's say. Then the first thing, of course, was more like, how do submarines look like nowadays? Mm-hmm. It's usually mostly let's call it a weapon system when you look at navies around the world, or True. It's something that's done or used by scientists to learn more about the oceans and what's down there, what's really down there, what we don't know about. Mm-hmm. So I had these two options, either make it a weapon system or make it something else. And yep. then as much as I knew about Adrian, I thought, okay, he served on a submarine, on a military submarine. Yep. I thought the exploratory submarine would be the right choice to remember him. So that was my idea then. So that's where I go. And then I immediately thought about Jules Verne, mm-hmm. the author. Correct me if my translation is wrong. 20,000 Fathoms Under the Sea or something like that?
Yeah, we would say 20,000 Leagues, but it's the same thing.
Leagues, okay. Yes. So so I had an idea what I would try to aim at. And then the internet is a big help when you do something, right? So I just entered Jules Verne and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and hit the images button. And then you get, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of different ideas of what something like this could look like. So I spent a good time watching it at pictures. There were some I did like a lot, some I didn't like that much, and then I kind of made a mixture of things I liked and put it into my own design. So that's how I came up with this special kit.
So I think there's some genius happening there that maybe is apparent to you, but is not to me because I don't have the skill set that you do. So you got these images, right? So you're able to see something. How do you take those images and take what you have in your head and then, and we'll have a photo of it on social media, but end up with a USS Adrian Benson? Because to me, there's a huge gap there where a lot has to happen. And how do you translate all this inspiration that you see and all these ideas that are going on in your head and then end up with this amazing 3D object that, to me, as soon as I saw it, I was like, whoa, that is definitely Jules Verne-esque. It screams Nautilus to me, but also it's different enough that it's uniquely Jorgen things from the basement. And so how do you blend all that? Because you do something, but I don't know how you do it.
I don't know if I can, I don't really know how to explain it or if I can explain it. It's just, I have different ideas or different images in my head, let's say. I made the research, I have images, I like this, I like that, I like this. So probably someone else who had some drawing skills just with a paper and pencil would probably draw something or sketch something out. I cannot do that. I tried that, it doesn't work for me. I just cannot.
Do you make models, laser cut models to see what works for you, or
no? What I do is I use the software I'm using for designing my laser cut kits, and I'm honest, I'm just using CorelDRAW, so no fancy cut software or something. I haven't used that before. I don't know. I'm working with CorelDRAW. It works fine for me. I will not change it, I guess. So I just start drawing. So I just try to put the ideas that I have into the pieces or parts that are needed to create this kit. It happens somewhere up here, I guess. I don't know, in my head, and I just start drawing. And for this coming back to the USS Adrian Benson, I thought that the best way to make a submarine usable in a game, because that's what my kids are supposed to be used for, would be a waterline model. So it's just the top of the submarine that you see when it's on the surface. So all the big body and all the ballast tanks and everything else you don't get in the model. You just get the waterline model. Just when you have a big battleship or sailing ship that's used in a game, all that's underneath the water is just not there. So it can sit on the table. You can move it around, and you have a nice, hopefully a nice piece of terrain in your game.
When I saw this, that was obviously, and I think for anyone who knows naval warfare, having it just be at the waterline is very apparent. And I was curious about your motivation for that, how much of it was practicality for game usage, and how much might have been inspiration based off of the subject matter. Because, I know it was unintended, but when I look at it and kind of having that waterline view of it and that flat view, it to a degree kind of reminded me of American Civil War ironclads. And Adrian had a huge, not as much as Napoleonics, but a huge love of history of the American Civil War. And he was fascinated by naval warfare as well. So the general shape of the main area of the USS Adrian Benson to me was reminiscent both of ironclads in general, but more particularly of the USS Manassas, how that kind of went with the sloped hull and using that. So I wasn't sure how much of that kind of came into it and how much was practicality and what sort of balance it was. Because for me, I would say, you do it, the practicality would always win out, but I wasn't quite sure about the other, like if there were other elements of inspiration to go with that.
Yeah, as I said, so building a waterline or designing a waterline model was a no-brainer for me, because I want to see it on gaming tables. When I go to conventions or see pictures on social media, I would like to see the model being used, not just sitting there as a display thing.
Yep.
So that was why the waterline. And you're right, it looks a bit, I didn't think about that, about the ironclad kind of style. It has slope walls and stuff like that. So that's just because I don't like everything straight. If a ship usually has, flowing lines, a bit streamlined probably, not everything is bulky and blocky. So I tried to add some elements with slope walls or some other elements that add some kind of, going back to Jules Verne, more like the Nautilus, more like some biological elements. I don't know if I should call it like that. Some round forms and curves as well. So it has this little tail, which looks like a bit like a fishtail in the end at the aft. So I just used my imagination and tried to get something that looks kind of realistic, but on the other hand, it's still, it's in the sci-fi section of the Victorian sci-fi area. So it should be a mixture of things possible or imaginary, kind of, yeah. That's what was my aim.
Well, I think you did a fantastic job with that, because I think you hit the mark perfectly.
Thanks a lot.
So you had mentioned you start drawing in Coral Draw.
Yes.
And see how it kind of fits together. How much tinkering do you do there before you do a first real world prototype?
It might sound a bit weird, but usually I plan it, or I design all the pieces to more or less the last detail. So even the texture on the deck or anything else, the decoration on the windows, whatever you have, I do it all from beginning to end. And when I think everything is done, I put it in the laser cut it out, and then put it together. And then I will see if it fits or if it doesn't fit. If there are any mistakes where mistakes happen. Almost every kid has some small mistakes, but usually it's nothing huge. It's something that's easily fixable for me. And then I have to, of course, correct the part that is wrong, recut it and exchange it, and then I can go on. But most of the time it works pretty well.
Now, with this particular kit, do you remember, was there a lot of modifications needed after your first printing of the model and putting it together, test fitting it and everything, until getting the finished version that people can get now?
As far as I remember, this was one of the fastest kits I've ever designed.
Whoa.
I think I'm not sure exactly of the timeline. I think we two talked on a Friday, or yep, were in contact on Friday. I sat down on the Saturday, did the design, probably even cut it in the same afternoon or whatever, and assembled it. And then the next day I started painting. So it was, I think, maybe there was a small mistake. I don't remember exactly, but nothing critical. So it just came together.
Well,
It was really a very fast and quick kit. And I decided I will paint it immediately because I want to get it out. It was I think from just the one weekend, including painting the whole thing. So
I remember when you told me you said you were going to be starting on a new product. I don't even remember if you told me what it was when you said there's going to be something new. And I knew you wanted to do something in memory of Adrian. And then next thing I know, it felt like the next moment, practically, you said, "Hey, what do you think of this?" And you sent me a picture. And I was like, "That's amazing. How did you?" And I thought maybe you had, I don't know if you had like some core ideas in the works all along that for like a new product. And then you thought like it would be a good fit, or I didn't know how the whole process went, but I just remember being amazed at how quickly it came to fruition and just how beautiful it was. It just really, impressed by your skill, and I've always appreciated your skill and how wonderful the kits are that you sell, but this really kind of drove home to me the fact that you are exceptionally good at what you do, and I hope others realize that. It can seem that maybe it's not that difficult to do what you do. I think it's incredibly difficult. I think not everyone can do this, and not everyone can do it as well and as quickly as you do. And you look at this kit, right? And it's deceptively simple, I think. But there's so much going on in the kit, and clear to me, so much thought had to go into the design process to be able to get it to like this. It doesn't just happen on its own.
Yeah, thanks again. I mean, everybody has some kind of skill, maybe hidden even still there. But my skill obviously is the designing process. I like doing it. I love doing it. And as soon as you told me that Adrian was with the US Navy and he was on a submarine, I knew what I would like to do. And then I came up, as I said, I started my research and came up with this kind of special submarine for him. So I don't, it's definitely a skill I have. I cannot really explain how it works, but it works. And I have to, just to make sure, not every kid goes that fast. I have others which take much, much longer. And no, sometimes you have an idea and try to realize and it doesn't really work, and then you put it aside and probably try again at a later time or whatever. So this was unusual. It was an unusual occasion, and the kit that came out was unusual in production as well, in its coming to existence as well. It was an unusual event.
No, that's true. But I think you perfectly described the creative process right there. And, I would say I have no skills, but
I don't think so.
People keep telling me that. I keep thinking everyone's wrong. But with the podcast, which is completely different, right, from what you do, and I would say definitely has like a modicum of creative process involved with it. And I know what you mean, because there'll be times where I'll have an idea for a show or a series of shows or things, and I'll talk to others and say, okay, let's do this. This is what we're going to do. Here's an idea. Let's try to hash it out and see how we can approach it. And then you try it and you think it's going to work. And then when, as we get closer to trying to set it up and maybe have a guest on or brainstorm what we're going to actually like the flow of it and how it's going to go, I'll think about it. I'm like, no, it doesn't quite work. And then I'll come back to it even years later. And then it'll come out. And so like I have, I use this thing where we kind of keep like outline of each episode, talking points and things that we're going to kind of cover. But in it, I have a whole thing where it's ideas for the show, for different topics and people and stuff. And some of these have been on here, I kid you not, for years, years and years and years. Things going back to early days, we're trying to figure out what's our new take on it. Because a lot of the stuff, and you might feel this way as well with some of the more mainstream kind of kits that you do, they've been done right by other people. So how can you make a cart new and unique to you? How can you make a Victorian science fiction submarine new and unique to you? How can you make a podcast episode about whatever topic? What's your unique take? So what'll draw people to you as a host or someone else? And so trying to find that nugget can be hard. And so I can only imagine how much more difficult it is with what you do, because you're going from ground zero all the way up to amazing things. And so I'm impressed.
Thanks. Yeah. Sometimes things have just to lay around and get better with age probably, and then it works. Or you get a different angle of view to solve the problem that you have somewhere sitting there, and then voila, it's there and you get it done.
No, that's true. That it's absolutely true. So you mentioned that this was kind of unusual, both in the speed that you got it done, but also the whole situation. And so let's talk about the situation a little bit, because I'm going to presume that kind of, and inspire might not be the right word, but that kind of motivated you and kind of touched deeper on an emotional level, maybe, that allowed you to kind of just dig right into this and get to the core of what would work and what you wanted for it. And to do so in a speedier way, but also to do it maybe in I can't think of the word, which is terrible for someone who's doing an audio podcast. But like a more, I don't want to say authentic, because it makes it seem like your other stuff isn't authentic, and it is. But just like that you connected with more. Mm-hmm. So why don't we talk a little bit about the inspiration is not a great word, but like what kind of the origin of all this?
Yeah.
So why were you making this?
So I saw I probably on a social media post from you that Adrian had passed away. I knew he was sick. So you tend then to, I don't know, probably push it away, close your eyes, don't think it will be that bad. But in the end, it was that bad. And I saw that he passed away. I have to say, I know he was exactly my age. That is probably another point that hit me in doing something special. I've met him a few times. I didn't really know him that well. I know that he was around with you on conventions with Wargaming Recon, and he was always the more the quiet part in the background, filming and taking pictures, and you were doing the talk as usual, which you are good in. So I knew him, and what happened to him just hit me, and I thought I have to do something. And then you reached out to me and asked if I would be willing to do something, and I said I already have my brain around it. I will do something. And then I worked the one weekend and showed you what I did, and you said that's great. And then my next thought was, okay, now I paint this thing, take pictures and make it available as a kit. And I also thought, as Adrian passed away from a type of cancer, that I would donate a part of the sales price to cancer research. And that's also on the website if you look at it. So I am doing that. If whenever a kid sells or a few kids sell, then I make another donation. And the painted kit I photograph for my personal use, for the kit itself, for the cover sheet and for the website and for posting on media. And then I asked you to give me the address of Adrian's wife, and I sent the painted kit to her as a memory for her to remember her husband. And I also came in contact with her a bit, and she wrote me a nice letter, and I will meet her in a few weeks. So we haven't met before, so it will be our first time, and we will meet and talk about him, I guess. So I mean, it was my way of being able to do something that he's not forgotten, at least not in the gaming world, where he was very present, I think. As I said, he was, at least my impression, more of the quiet type. But he was a very nice guy, and I wish I would have had more contact with him when I did have the opportunity to do so. So that kind of makes you think maybe you should change some things in your life and appreciate the time that you have, as long as you have it, and do more with it.
So I got to tell you, I don't know if you ever knew this, he was a huge fan of yours and your work. Absolutely loved what you did. Loved your kits. And I remember when he first started talking to me about MDF, he talked about a company that you actually ended up working with, Foreground. And he was talking about them, and he thought they would be of interest to me because they were pre-painted, basically, so that you get it. You didn't have to do anything. And we were at Huzzah one year, and you happened to be vending, and we're walking around, and then he and I kind of separated and just kind of looking at other stuff. And he said, oh, you should come check this out. There's this booth and they're selling MDF kits. I was like, oh, okay, let's go take a peek. And it was your booth. And so we're looking at, I know we bought stuff. I can't remember what we bought, but I remember him saying afterwards that he was really impressed by your line of stuff and that he wished he had more money to buy more stuff of yours, because he picked up a few things, and I don't remember exactly what he picked up, but I do know some of it was some of the smaller sets you had, some of the kind of accessories carts and things like that. And there was one that he said that he'd been looking for something like that and never been able to find it. And then we would see you at conventions whenever we would go to Huzzah. It would always come up, and so we'd plan in advance, oh, what things from the basement gonna have, what can we get, what can we go look and see, what new stuff is gonna be there. And not just excitement over what you created, but you. And so he, like you said, he was very reserved, and I know some would say stoic or a bit of a curmudgeon. And that was just kind of his public facing face. When you could break through that, it would be delightful. I've said before, one of the greatest things for me would be to get him to laugh. It wasn't easy, but being able to make him laugh was worth every moment of it. But he wouldn't do it out in public usually. You'd have to get him alone. And so he would always just be like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. He's very motivated by whatever the task was at hand. But after each time of interacting with you and being with you, he would just talk a lot about just how nice you were and how wonderful it was, that what you were working on. And you could tell that he knew that you got it when it came to what made historical terrain work and how to go about doing it. So he was a huge fan of yours. And I wish that he had been able to express that more directly from him to you.
It's great to hear that. I mean, as I said, I've seen him. We talked the usual convention talk, I guess, and a bit more because of Wargaming Recon, but I didn't really know the person Adrian very well, so and that's something we should always keep in mind, because I mean, our time isn't endless. At one point in time, so we should make the best use of it, and getting to know people a bit better might be a good start.
No, I agree. I've had many lessons I've learned from his passing. That's one of them. I've been lucky to have had many, many years with him, more than with my wife, actually. But it wasn't long enough. And in many ways, I feel that there were large chunks of time that I could have used better with him. And I think that kind of translates for people, no matter who else is in our lives. There's ways we can try to be more present. And it's a good thing. I know for him, and his wife may have mentioned it to you, and I know she had mentioned it to me too, that as things were going near the end, she would tell him about the public response, I guess, to the news about him. And he was shocked and surprised and confused, I think, in that he didn't think that he deserved any of it. And he didn't think that he left a mark with anyone. And so for him to know about all this, I know he appreciated it very much so, and it touched him a lot. But I also know he was like, why do people do this? He felt he was undeserving of it. And for me anyway, that's part of a reason that I love him. It was so authentic.
Yeah, right. I mean, I guess that's the way he was, right? He's not the one standing out in front. He's more in the background type, but he was a very important person, I guess, for you personally and for your podcast. So it's not just the outer appearance that's important. It's the knowing what's inside, which is even more important than anything else.
Well, there's that age old dynamic for those who do any sort of, I guess, show business is probably the best way to put it, where you have, you know, the straight man and then the one who I'm going to refer to as the goofball. I think it's very clear who I am and clearly who he was. And I mean, authentic on both of us, but I mean, of course we play it up because that's what you do, but like very real. And there would be many conversations off air. And the one I think of the most would be about the show's intro and outro, which is very cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
And one time we talked actually a lot about it, but one time he was like, you know, that's a bit much. Maybe you can tone it down. And I was like, okay, let's try doing it without it. So we tried for a few episodes. And then I remember asking about it. He said, yeah, that doesn't work. You got to go do the thing. And just, it was really fun. But like, he was someone you can always have a very honest opinion from and really good advice. For gaming, just a tactical mind, he appreciated and understood rules and how games worked. And so when it would come to like an MDF kit, for example, he knew innately how it should work on the table and how it would interact with a game and a rule set. And he could just kind of tell that by looking at what you would have at your vendor booth and be like, okay, this is something that we can use. This would be good for this, that, and like, how will that interact? And meanwhile, I would be looking and be like, that looks so pretty. Let's see about that. That looks really neat. What's this cool new thing that's going to be? And so he would kind of help ground all that. So it was really nice, but it definitely drawn to your work.
Yeah, it's good to hear. And I can totally figure that he was that kind of guy. Yes.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, a lot of fun with it to kind of just, he could run with stuff and you could see there.
So
The inner glee, but other people, he would try to hide that.
When you played games with him, was he intent on winning, or was it more important for him to play and have fun?
Both. He not overly competitive, but he wanted to make sound strategic and tactical decisions when he would do it. And I'd be like, this seems like this would be a fun thing to do. So let's try this. And he'd be like, okay. And so I tried, and of course it wouldn't work out, but it would be exciting. And he'd say, you know, that probably wasn't the wisest move. I know, but wasn't that fun? Well, yeah, it was, but It was a nice balance.
Yeah.
So that's kind of been how the USS Adrian Benson came about. And I know you've worked on other projects since then. So you've added some more to your Historic American Buildings line. And you've done, what else have you done? You've done a couple others since then. I'm trying to
remember. Honestly, it's hard to remember when I'm trying to figure that out because for me, it's like going to the last convention sometime in 2019 and now starting to go back in 2022. So it's almost 2.5-3 years where you continued on designing and releasing new kits online, but you haven't brought them to any conventions or shows. So now I still have to figure out, oh, did I bring that to a show anytime? No, I did not. So let me just try to, out of my head, a few things that I did. And starting with the Victorians, I think the whole Victorian science fiction range, more or less, I never had it at a convention. So that's all brand new stuff. So you have British style airships for fights on Mars, and there's a German one as well. There is some kind of, I call it the land train, like a very special rugged terrain thing that transports troops or material over Mars. There is a mono wheel. So I did some Victorian sci-fi stuff, which I enjoy doing because it's so different than just a historic building. you can enter some own, your own ideas into it. It's just not trying to get a building that is somewhere standing, getting it right in the right scale.
Before you move on to the next one, I have to ask you.
Yes.
How do you pronounce the German airship from your Victorian science fiction line?
So that it's called Sperling, which is sparrow in English.
Okay.
The little brown bird, Sperling.
So it's torpedo something something.
How do I call it?
So I'm a terrible person of German descent because I cannot. Torpedo Fluggerät?
Yeah, no, that's it. Torpedo Fluggerät. So thank you. And I tried to put the English word in. So torpedo is, that's the same. Fluggerät is just a flying thing. Torpedo Fluggerät Sperling.
Okay.
So I thought I would do it German, right? For this special. And there will be more coming, I'm pretty sure. So there will be more German words.
you need to do a pronunciation guide with them, please.
I will try that. Okay, good idea. See?
Because poor individuals like me, we look at it, we go, that yes. One.
I'm looking forward when I'm selling it on conventions and people try to say what they want to buy. So I'm looking forward to their pronunciations.
That would be funny, actually.
But the finger always helps. If you can point to it, it will help. We will get you covered with a kit.
This one right here is wonderful. You do the Disney point with the two or three fingers.
Yes.
Over here.
Yeah. So I also did some historical buildings. I'm not sure we talked. I did a whole range of buildings that are located on the Gettysburg battlefield. I call them farms of Gettysburg. They're all farm buildings, more or less.
They're beautiful.
So that I will bring to shows because I haven't done that before. Then I did another one for Lexington and Concord. There's the Hartwell Tavern, which is a very prominent building on the Battle Road. I did that.
Yeah, that's it. That's a set I don't have, but I've been looking at off and on for quite a while because it's very aesthetically pleasing. And separated it out into three kits.
Right, because
you can also get it as a set.
In 1775, there was only the main building present. Right now, it's three, when you go there and visit the national park, it's three buildings that are connected. So I decided to do the whole ensemble because I like the look of it a lot, knowing it's not the way it should be if you are into the Revolutionary War, but you can take the buildings apart. So you have, in fact, you you can buy them separately, or you can get the whole set and use the other two add-ons as individual buildings. So that works fine. Then you can do whatever you want with them. And I think they are pretty close to the time period, but they were just not there in 1775. So that's why.
No, the beautiful.
And what else did I do? I did another because I love that range a lot, the feudal Japan range. I did a samurai residence, which is a pretty big piece of terrain. It's more or less three separate buildings put together on a wooden deck with a little courtyard in the middle, and then you also have a fence around, or a fence that goes partly around it, so you have a little garden area that you can use for gaming and for decorating, of course. So I like that a lot.
Yeah, that one. Well, for me, that one is very cinematic. I don't know that I've seen that exact kind of look in any samurai film, but it feels like I have. You know what I mean? It feels like it came out of a movie.
Yeah. I wanted to do something, not just another, let's say, single building or two or three different single buildings that you can put together. I wanted to be able to have something that's something special, something like a centerpiece for the gaming table. And because we talked about it before, there are other laser cut kit manufacturers. And I mean, the feudal Japanese period is very popular. I find it quite surprising that it is, because it's very exotic. Well, that's mm-hmm. probably the reason why, because the figures look nice too when they are painted. It's very colorful and special and not unusual for us Americans, Western Europeans. It's the Oriental Asia that we like to play with. So, but I wanted to do something special, not just buildings, something that belongs together, is a bit bigger, and can be used maybe as the sole terrain piece if you add trees and roads and other things around it. And that's how I came up with this one.
For me, it's kind of a piece of art, because I could see that as someone getting it, you have it painted up, and you just have it on display somewhere in your house as home decor. It just kind of adds a nice touch.
Yeah, I tried. If from every angle you look at it, it looks different. So there's not, the front is very decorative and the back is not. I don't think so. I think I tried to. It has a lot of nooks and crannies and corners, and the pitched roofs are different. And so there's a lot to digest when you look at it. And I think adding a few figures and just put it on display is not the baddest idea, the worst idea.
Yeah. So these are some of the sets that you're going to be bringing to conventions, but I'm sure you're working on something new.
Oh, now comes to that.
What do you have lined up?
Yes, I do. I'm always working on something, that for sure. So,
you know, I have to ask. I have to find out what new releases are coming or what you can tease.
Yeah, I already teased it, I think, just before I went on a longer vacation. But I haven't really worked on it since then. So I'm still working on it.
Uh-huh.
I think what I can tell you, it will be at least that was my initial idea, a German setting, like half timbered buildings.
Cool.
Which could be used, I don't know. You can use it from Napoleonics to World War I, World War II, and the buildings are still there today. So it's a wide range of periods that you can cover with it, which I think is always nice, because people turn around their pennies before they purchase something, and if they can use it for multiple settings, that's always a plus. So that's what I'm working on. It will take a while, at least a few more, I don't know. I don't want to say when I will release it, but I guess not in July, maybe in August. So I'm working on it.
So maybe sometime in 2022,
I think so. Yes,
2022, or early 2023.
I would say 2022 is my goal. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, let's give you some time. We don't want to box you in.
Yeah. No, 2022. I think I can commit to.
And will this be a whole range, or will this be a few sets, or?
It will be a whole range. So it will be different buildings and then the usual stuff that you need with this, like fences or walls or a barn or something like that. So usually I try to do not just one building, but rather a few, so you can create a little village or put something at the corner of the table to try to recreate the beginning of a bigger city or settlement or whatever. So it will be a few buildings.
Very cool. I'm looking forward to that. And will you just launch it, or do you think you'll do a Kickstarter for it?
That I'm still a bit undecided about how to do it. Maybe it will be a Kickstarter, yes. I'm not sure yet. We'll see.
Okay. We won't hold you to it. And so you said you're going to Historicon this year. And then what other conventions are you planning to do in 2022 and early 2023?
So it will be Historicon in July. It will be ArmorCon in October, which is a new one for us. I've never been there. So try something new, right?
Yeah.
After COVID, everything gets restart and try new. So
absolutely,
we'll try that. And then for 2023, I think we will be back at Huzar. This year we couldn't make it because of family affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think TotalCon again, that's even before, that's in February usually.
Yeah, that's February.
So we'll February, TotalCon, May, Huzar, and then next year again, Historicon, I would say. Yeah, and that's the plan. So two more for this year, and then next year we'll continue.
That's a lot. That's a lot to do, a lot of travel.
It's a lot of work too, because you have to prepare, you have to have enough kids, you have to decide which kids do I take. I cannot take everything. It's just not possible. No. So I try to hopefully bring the right collection of stuff. But usually my wife Petra is with me on conventions, so mm-hmm. I don't do it alone, because then it's not fun anymore. So you need someone who helps you and covers you your do. Back when you need to get your 5 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's fun to meet people, to meet customers, to meet other vendor colleagues, game masters, whatever. It's always fun to talk to them, chat with them, find out what are other companies doing, get new ideas from games you see, and just get inspiration from being at conventions. That's the best thing. And meeting friends, of course.
Yeah. I have a different experience of going to conventions than you do, because I'm not stuck at a booth all day. But often when I go, I don't go just to play games. I actually almost never get to play games. I go because they're working events and we're networking and everything. And in the past, I mean, Adrian would be my plus one. We would go and we would just kind of tackle and spell each other. So it's kind of, for me, a new dynamic. So we're actually going to be going to a Lego convention in August down in Virginia. Be doing that for the show, which might sound like an odd thing, but there's a lot of historicals and militaria in Lego. So there's some nice crossover. And then be at ArmorCon as well. And so for both of those two, I'm going with a new buddy of mine, Anthony, who owns a Lego store. Lego's his thing, so it'd be neat to kind of get his take at the Lego Con. But then ArmorCon will be new for both of us, and just kind of see how that goes. So it should be fun and interesting. But it's always much more fun when you have someone else with you, I think.
That's right. I think it's just more fun in general, having someone you can discuss things with and show. Four eyes see more than two, so it's always a different perspective, especially when he's from the not wargaming wargaming perspective, and vice versa when you go to the Lego convention. It's the same.
It's going to be very interesting, a lot of fun, I think.
Yeah.
So if listeners want to keep up to date with all the things you're working on, what's the best way for them to do that?
Usually, the most or the best thing I would say is the website itself. Mm-hmm. It's thingsfromthebasement.com. Then I also more or less regularly post on Facebook and Instagram. Sometimes you get a peek of what's coming or what I'm working on the social media. And on the website, you can usually see what is available right now or on to what conventions we go, or you get all the instructions if you have a kit already, and you can click through and download the instruction you need. So yeah, website and social media usually is the best way to get updates on what's happening at Things from the Basement.
No, that sounds really good. And for us here at Wargaming Recon, people can check us out on social media. We're on all the things as Wargaming Recon. So no matter where you look, we're everywhere. We don't do the TikTok, but we're on the Insta or the Gram, I think the kids call it. We're on Twitter, Facebook. We're all over the place. So we are everywhere, and you can get that. And you can also get episodes of the show by listening to us from your favorite podcatcher, podcast app. We're on Apple Podcasts. We're on Stitcher. We're on Google Play, all the things all the time. So you can have the pleasure or the terror of listening to my voice should you choose. Jorg, thank you so much for being on this episode. I really, really appreciate it. And thank you for spending the time with us.
Thanks for having me. It was fun as usual. I've done that before. yeah, it was nice to talk with you and give the listeners an impression on how my magical brain works to get you the nice kids. And I couldn't explain it, I know, but that's the way it is. You just have to live with that.
For me, it's always interesting to kind of get a glimpse of the creative process and how it presents itself to different individuals. And that's been a great thing with the show, kind of being able to see those in different areas present their creative process and just kind of see how it all kind of works. I think it's fascinating. And I think listeners enjoy it too. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
Well, everyone, I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen to this episode of Wargaming Recon. Be sure to visit thingsfromthebasement.com. Check out all the stuff that Jorg's working on, all the things that are for sale. Get your copy of the USS Adrian Benson. And remember, money from that gets donated to cancer research to help out others so that maybe someone else doesn't have to go through what Adrian and his family has gone through as well. So everyone, thank you so, so much. And you know the drill. No matter how busy you are, no matter what's going on in your life, no matter how much time you're thinking, what kit should I get from Things from the Basement next? You know that you gotta, you need to, you have to. That's right. Keep on gaming. Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Casts, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon on your mobile device. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Wargaming Recon is dedicated to the memory of longtime listener Andrew. I ask all listeners to join me in a moment of silence in memory of Andrew. Thank you to everyone who backed our 2021 podcast season on Kickstarter. In particular, we'd like to thank 3DDZYN at 3ddesign.com, Nate Taylor of Dwarven Forge, and Things from the Basement, where you can get highly detailed laser cut terrain kits for 28, 20, and 15 millimeter figures and other exciting products. We couldn't have been successful without the help of all of you. Thank you so much for your support and being part of our community. We hope you are enjoying the 2021 season.